You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Later this hour, our guest tries to follow the money from a network of conservative donors led by the Koch brothers.
First, a lot of older Americans need reading glasses, but a new eye drop could eliminate the need for those pesky glasses. Our science expert, Gemma Tarlak, explains how these drops work and when they might be available.
She'll also talk about how gender affects epigenetics and the science behind earworms, those songs that get stuck in your head and just won't go away. Gemma Tarlak is senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the coolest headlines from the science world. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, thank you again for having me.
Well, let's start with these corrective eye drops that could take the place of reading glasses, I guess. How do they work?
Yeah, so this is really fascinating work, and it's actually pretty close to being out there on the shelf. Basically, as all of us age, the lens of our eyes stiffen. And this is important because if you're looking at the light rays from a nearby object, say closer than 30 feet, those light rays enter the eye at an angle, and the lens has to be supple enough to bend to take in the light rays correctly. And as we get older, the lens stiffens, can't quite take in those rays like it should be, so the image gets really blurry. The doctors combined two different drugs that are already out there, and they found a way to, this sounds worse than it is, trust me, they found a way to temporarily constrict the pupil of your eye. That sounds awful, but trust me, follow me on this. It creates this pinhole camera effect, and that makes the image super clear, but because it's essentially a pinhole effect, it also makes the image dark. So they created these eye drops where you put them in one eye, okay? I know that sounds crazy, but trust me, it works. You put them in one eye, so the eye with the eye drops sees the image clear but dark, and the eye without the eye drops sees the image bright but blurry, and mash them up together in your brain, and your brain actually sees the image as sharp and bright. So you don't need your reading glasses.
That's amazing. That sounds like
it's crazy.
Stuff of sci-fi to me, but you're saying these are eye drops that could be available in the nearish future?
Yeah, you know, they've done really successful trials with 48 people. Now, that's a small group, but the trials are very successful, so they're already looking into ways to ramp it up and, you know, find someone to sell these things.
And this is for people, now this is not for people who are wearing glasses for their daily use. This is for, hey, to read this book or a computer screen or whatever, I need
right.
reading glasses.
Yeah, exactly. This would replace reading glasses. If, you know, you have other issues with your eyes, sorry, so far you're on your own.
but maybe that's a next step? I mean, could there be some sort of, or is this being viewed as a, you know, one step toward a non-glasses correction and non-laser correction of eyes?
Really specific. It's addressing one really specific element of age-related eye issues, and that is the stiffening of the lens. Now, they may very well find related therapies that actually are good for other conditions, but right now it's pretty narrow, the condition they're trying to treat.
Obviously, these are not out there yet, and
no.
I have a lot of questions, though. So do you need to use these just in the morning? Is it good for all day, or would this be something you just put in right before you read, and then they're good for 15 minutes or something?
Well, they found that after they put the eye drops in, the pupils gradually, the effect wore off, basically, over time, over about 10 hours. So they're thinking it might be something you have to put in, like, once a day, each morning, maybe, and then just don't read at night, I guess. But it's, you know, about a 10-hour effect.
Well, let's switch gears now to a field that a lot of people are really excited about, this idea of epigenetics, where our genes determine some things, but they switch on and off. First of all, before we get to the new stuff, summarize epigenetics better than I just did.
Well, you know, we're all born with DNA, our own special blend of DNA. We got some from our mom, some from our dad, and we'll pass, you know, half of it on to our kids, essentially. We always thought for decades, your DNA is your DNA. You know, you're born with it, and unless you get in contact with some really awful chemicals that can change it, your DNA is your DNA. Now we're finding that's true to a point. There are all these chemical switches, some of them hormonally based, that if you have a specific gene, there's a chemical switch that can turn it on or off. And that's basically what epigenetics is, looking at those chemical switches and trying to understand how they can turn on and off. And what we're finding out is environment has a lot to do with the genes that get expressed. In other words, the genes get turned on, and the genes that don't get expressed, or the genes that get turned off by these chemical switches. And something that's really fascinating is a lot of your epigenetics, a lot of your chemical switches, come from your parents and specifically the experiences your parents had. And, you know, the author starts looking at research done about children of Holocaust survivors, because they found that children of Holocaust survivors, now these are children born after the Holocaust, they were not alive at all when it went on, but they were born afterward. They found that these children had very high rates of anxiety, exhibited like PTSD symptoms, had other real difficulties functioning, and they always assumed for decades that it was learned behavior, you know, that it was that they were picking up cues from their parents who had lived through this horrible trauma. But now they're finding actually epigenetically there is evidence that the trauma and the horrible experiences that the parents survived affected the chemical switches that turned on and off and actually left their children open to, you know, gene expression of things like anxiety or depression or other issues. And so it's not just that they were picking up cues from their parents, but they were actually their parents' DNA expression was changed chemically, epigenetically.
And Gemma, what do we know about what kind of practical application this could have for people later on?
Well, you know, obviously this is a very specific example, children of Holocaust survivors. But speaking more broadly, they're finding more and more evidence of things like this, that the parents' environment changed the chemical switches, and they passed those changes on to their children. So we're actually finding reasons how, you know, autism, schizophrenia, these are diseases that or disorders that affect people differently in terms of sex, you know. Males are much more likely to have autism, to have schizophrenia, whereas females are much more likely to have depression and other issues. And we're finding that there are a lot of clues that it's epigenetic switches. So this may lead to, well, first of all, better research, research that's more focused, and also, ideally, one day, better therapies and treatments.
And this is interesting because at one point I think we thought, okay, we map the genome and then we can puzzle everything out. We just look at your genes and we're going to know everything. This epigenetics thing is exciting, but it's way more complicated.
Oh, my gosh, it is so much more complicated because, you know, even if your parents had, you know, a great life and no awful experiences, you still, as a person, as an individual, you go through, say, puberty, you know, and, you know, if you're a woman, maybe you go through pregnancy, and those are hormonal storms that really also affect the epigenetic switches on and off in ways that we're just understanding. So it's fascinating work, and I think it's going to be hugely important, but we're still at the opening chapter of that book.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, getting the latest in science news. And Gemma, we're going to wrap up now with a topic everybody's had experience with, earworms. So, so we are sure we're talking about the same thing. What is an earworm?
An earworm. Oh my gosh. If your friends don't dance, then if they're no friends of mine, you know, it's that snippet of a song that gets stuck in your head and repeats and repeats and repeats and repeats and basically makes you crazy. And yeah, so it's a thing. It's not just like in your imagination. And there's research that finds out the more importance you put to music, like if you really love music and you're really passionate about it, and if you listen to it a lot, you are more likely to have more frequent and longer earworm infestations.
Infestations. Good word.
Yeah, so I've always been curious. I mean, I get these all the time. Sometimes it's a song I love. Often it is not. So why? What is it about our brains that just latch on and won't let go?
Well, first, I just have to say, don't worry, be happy.
Don't.
Well, they're finding, actually, people who get a lot of earworms, they have certain portions of their brain, like they have a thinner right frontal cortex, which is associated with inhibition. And other parts of the brain seem to indicate that these folks are just not as good at suppressing that song. And it also, again, if you listen to a lot of music, you're more likely to get them. A couple other factors. If you're worried or stressed or fatigued, you're more likely to get earworms, which scientifically, I think we all should know this term, involuntary musical imagery. That's what earworms technically are, scientifically speaking. Involuntary musical imagery.
Huh. Okay, so how do we get rid of them? Do we know anything about how to treat ourselves?
Yes. A couple quick tips. One of them is exposure. Sit down and listen to the entire song, even if it is Survivor's Eye of the Tiger. Just sit down and listen to it. And actually, the exposure kind of helps your brain kind of get off that record-skipping repeat loop. Also, distraction. There are a couple different ways of doing distraction. If you come up with a competing melody, for example, you know, if you have, I don't know, I don't even want to mention a bad song, but if you have a really terrible song stuck in your head, listen to another song, sing aloud another song, right, and kind of replace it. There's another form of distraction that's really new and hasn't been widely tested, but I'm going to try it, actually, the next time I get an earworm. And that is to sing the song out loud, to sing that earworm out loud, but as you do it, change it up. Change some of the words, change the melody a little bit, maybe, you know, move it into a minor key if you want. And that should do it. That should do the trick, and your brain should kind of get off that awful loop of repetition.
When I'm stuck on a song I don't like, I'll at least convert it into a ska version of the song or a heavy metal version in my head, and that is like, oh, it's actually kind of cool that way.
Yeah, that's actually one of the distraction forms to get rid of it.
I'm just worried about what you're going to be like in the office now. Now that Jenna's given you permission to sing all
out
these
loud,
songs.
And I'm a good singer.
All right, well, we're going to go out with producer Amanda Magnus's favorite earworm. Sorry, everybody. This is the safety dance.
Gemma, thanks as always.
Oh, I can dance if I want to.
All right. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time after a look at the latest news.